Now, you may only see a pile of receipts, but I see a story. I can see where this story is going. It does not look good.
Hello and welcome to the Rollbeat Pod, a 32 Fans podcast, where we discuss all things movies, past, present, and occasionally future. My name is Sammy Chester.
And I'm John Gilpatrick, and today we have a supersized episode. We're going to be talking about the movies of the first quarter, 2022. And to do that with us is the great Aaron Brooks.
Very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Choice in the matter, right?
Yeah, I've not been introduced by the great before. So also known as Zach's little brother, or he's my big brother, whichever is less insulting.
Aaron, listeners will remember you weren't known as my little brother or Zach's brother. You were known as my brother, Aaron, who is a movie expert. So long before you joined us, I think in 2019, perhaps, or 2020, yep, on the podcast, you had this growing legend that your brother had spun around you. We're excited to bring you on. I think we discussed The Vast of Night.
Yes.
In the past. Normally, we try to start with a March of the year and skip January, February. But we did want to bring on a real expert if we were going to have a slower start to the year. Is that a way to call it, John?
I think you could say that, but it'll be telling. We're going to talk about our top five respective movies so far of 2022. And how much April contributed to that, and maybe how different these lists could have looked if we only did January through March like we normally do.
Yeah, if we would have done a first 3 months of the year, I think it would have been a pretty, I don't know if I would have been able to name five movies I'd seen that came out this year, but definitely not five that I liked. So
no,
Aaron would have had to do all the heavy lifting. How about before we do that, Aaron, if you want to start us off, give us the movie that has come out as far as, you know, your knowledge in 2022, you still haven't had a chance to catch up with. And then also the movie that you did have a chance to see and that you were most disappointed by, bottom line, that you would tell people to skip.
A lot of people, including my brother, Zach, would be surprised that I've missed, is The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. In terms of Nicolas Cage, like, I'm a decent fan. I loved Pig last year, for example, and there's other ones, Con Air. There's ones along the way that I do love of his, getting to theaters reserved for A24 first and foremost, and then everything else for me. I think it's right up my alley. Nicolas Cage last action hero deal. Yeah, that would be the one say I missed that I wish I would have caught up with before this. And for the movie I say to skip, Death on the Nile. A bunch of really, really beautiful people not caring about what they were doing. And I was checked out of the movie pretty immediately. I didn't really care for the first either. So, I mean, I kind of signed up for it anyways. I was at home. It was on Hulu, I think.
You inspired me in advance because I have already skipped that and I had no intention.
If you didn't see it when it came out, you're never going to see that movie.
Disappears almost upon arrival.
This year is going back good old days of how movies are. If you want to really be on top of your new releases, you're going to have to be out at the theaters. Aaron, that's what I'm trying to sort of piece together, because most of the movies on my list, at least, I think are not yet really streaming. And most of the movies I saw are only in theaters.
I just still live in the movie pass era where I still definitely make time for the movies I go to. And I think for the most part, maybe initially that may elevate my feelings on the movies because I am making time and making the plan to figure out to see them, or it's making them really disappointing when I go to see them. And I'm lucky to live in Washington, D.C., right by an independent movie theater, so I get to see a ton of these movies way early on.
My catch-up called Great Freedom. It stars Franz Rogowski. Franz Rogowski is the discount Joaquin Phoenix in terms of kind of what he looks like. So he was in Transit in 2020. Yeah. And then last year, he was in a movie about sort of a modern day mermaid tale.
Undine,
that was it. Yeah. So Franz Rogowski, I've been very impressed by both of those movies and him in both of them, particularly Transit. Great Freedom is a story. Franz Rogowski plays a gay intellectual who was sent to the prison system in Germany in sort of the post-war era. I've heard great things about it. The one I would skip, and I'm not sure if I'm going to already run into some Aaron Brooks trouble. I was more excited for After Yang than almost any other movie that was coming out this year.
This is on my list.
If this is on your top five, I will leave my criticisms for later. So we'll see what Aaron has to say later. But for now, if you cut off the podcast 5 minutes in, don't go see After Yang unless Aaron convinces you otherwise.
Fair enough. I have one movie that I haven't caught up with that I suspect we'll talk about in a bit, which is Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Yep.
Arguably the most acclaimed movie so far this year. And then another movie that we've said I think people should skip because I'm quite certain it's not on either of your top five lists is Moonfall. Roland, am I wrong, Aaron? Is this on your top five?
This is not on my top five. No, you can carry on.
So this is the Roland Emmerich movie. He of Independence Day fame basically redid it, but with a hook that I guess naively excited about. I'm like, what if the moon fell? I was really disappointed that not only is it a fake fall, but it's also a fake moon. I signed up for a proper moon fall and I did not get a proper moon fall. And it disappointed me in that respect.
Don't Look Up versus Moonfall. Which one was more entertaining?
Don't Look Up didn't bother me the same way I think it bothered you. Fall is sort of offensively stupid. They said moonfall and it's not a moonfall. I wanted like a proper moonfall.
It sounds like a James Bond movie.
Well, because Skyfall and Moonraker.
Yeah.
Sequel will be Skyraker.
Before we jump into our top fives, but I was really in need of some comedic cinematic distraction, shall we say, over the last few months. I went back to the golden era as far as a child born in the 80s. Comedies in the 90s reached a peak that certainly haven't been equaled in the last maybe, 10, 15, 20 years. I felt like I really needed to see some good comedies. And so I said, okay, let me go look at a few lists and I can show the list in the show notes. 50 best comedies of the 90s, see which of them have I not seen and try to catch up a bit. Let me give you maybe like the six or seven of the ones that stuck out a bit more. There's Something About Mary I couldn't finish. Midway through, I gave up. I tried to go back to it and I just gave up again. So I'm not even putting that on my list. I remember when that came out in 1998. And I remember it was like a very thing in the pop culture for a while. I don't know why.
Oh yeah.
It was huge.
Humongous movie.
Yeah. I found it so boring to watch. I have some strong opinions about what's considered a comedy. These three, none of them are a comedy as far as I'm concerned. One of them is Ed Wood, is the Johnny Depp movie about that like horror director in the 1930s. Or the 1940s.
Yeah.
Fun movie. I don't think it's comedy whatsoever. If anything, it's kind of sad. Dazed and Confused and Kicking and Screaming.
Yeah, Baumbach versus Linklater.
Yeah. Dazed and Confused, high school kids in the 70s, kind of in their last week before they graduate as they sort of trumble around town. And Kicking and Screaming, kind of the same story, 5 years
ago. Same thing, yeah.
I enjoyed both Dazed and Confused and Kicking and Screaming in particular. I just wouldn't consider either of them like a laugh fest.
We've talked on previous episodes about my sort of distaste for coming of age movies. Mm-mm. So they fall in that category.
I like Dazed and Confused. I love the soundtrack. It's one of the first CDs that was in my car. Definitely like Ed Wood. I wouldn't consider it a comedy, though. Definitely not a 90s comedy.
Wayne's World. It's cruel to watch it. I know Mike Myers through Austin Powers. And so I always thought of him as this incredible comedic genius. I realized like he has a whole career way before Austin Powers. And therefore, I went into Wayne's World being like, oh, yeah, the guy in Austin Powers is going to be great. Complete disaster. I found it not funny at all. It was a bit of Saturday Night Live that was dragged out into a whole movie. And I usually find that when you try to do that, it doesn't work. The other three, okay, but they're not special. My Cousin Vinny, also from 1992. Kingpin, the Farrelly Brothers movie from 1996. And Election, 1999. I know it's a movie that some people really love.
Yeah, none of those I'm crazy about. I did really like My Cousin Vinny when I saw it recently for the first time. So I'm surprised. I disagree with you all the time on movies. So
I used to write for a website called The Sin Essential, and we did a podcast, RIP. We covered Election the week of the Clinton-Trump election. And it was, let me just say, uncomfortable because of the parallels of what was sort of happening. After that, the election results came in and everything that transpired, we all felt very scarred by the movie Election. And I haven't had sort of the nerve to revisit it since or the interest. That experience of watching at that time and just like seeing like the parallels were was shocking.
It's well made.
I find it very uncomfortable, like statutory rape, if at all, I guess.
Also, when you think of Alexander Payne, the director of Election, all of his movies have a certain kind of dark humor or like a dark comedic element. This one is definitely the most flat out comedy.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Let me give you the two that I really liked. Quick Change, Bill Murray movie from 1990, and Clerks, of course, from the mid 90s. Oh. So Clerks to me is an all-timer, the funniest and the most memorable. Another sequel to Clerks is coming out this year. But Quick Change, people probably have heard of less. It's just like a really simple story. Bill Murray robs a bank with his girlfriend, Gina Davis, and Randy Quaid. Randy Quaid, I didn't realize this. he was like before Jim Carrey, the discount Jim Carrey. He has that wild manic comedic energy and this like physical force in both Kingpin, obviously, and then also in this movie. It's a certain manic Jim Carrey-esque. But anyways, they rob a bank in New York and then they just drive around New York City trying to get to the airport, which is surprisingly difficult for them.
I've seen both of them. I like them both. Clerk, I agree with you. That's probably the strongest of the ones you mentioned. All have had a job or I feel like an experience that we can relate to the characters in Clerks 1 or all of the characters, depending on how lucky you are. And I like the sequel too. Clerks 2 is fun.
John, have you seen Quick Change?
No, I've never seen Quick Change. I didn't really know anything about it.
Classic, like Bill Murray's sense of humor.
Yeah.
The best part of Kingpin is Bill Murray, just kind of an asshole bad guy. And Quick Change, he just gets to dominate the whole movie. Here's the ones I haven't yet caught up with. Just name one from this list I should see first above the rest. Birdcage, What About Bob from 1991, Liar Liar, Half-Baked, LA Story from 1991, My Fellow Americans from the mid-90s, Hot Shots, that's making fun of the first Top Gun, and So I Married an Axe Murderer from 1993.
If I did one, I would have talked about LA Story because I watched it recently. It was the first time I'd ever seen it. I found it to be really enjoyable. It's as close to like a Woody Allen as like a movie without Woody Allen, you know, could be. It feels very much like a Sleepers or Love and Death or Banana. That if you like those Woody Allen movies, then I think you'll dig LA Story.
So I don't know if you'll like it or not. You'll probably hate it because I love it. So I'll set it up that way. But So I Married an Axe Murderer is a perfect movie, start to finish. Every single line, not a line misplaced. I think Shakespeare came back from the dead to write this. It's just perfect.
I will catch those up and I will release, I guess, my definitive 90s comedies now having caught them up. I love when you rank things that you saw when you were a kid, like Home Alone, versus something you saw now in your 30s, like Kingpin. Always a bit of a controversial head-to-head. But leaving that aside, let's talk about something less controversial. Our top five. We're going to do this 32 fans. There will be pod style. Someone's movie is higher ranked and we'll wait to discuss it when it comes up on their list. So, Aaron, you want to start us off with your number five?
I will put After Yang. It was not my fifth. It was originally my third, but I'm just going to reschedule it up to my fifth here.
I will take your moving it down to five as a compromise on my hate.
Definitely, this is a movie that clearly isn't for everybody, as from your list earlier. After Yang is essentially about a family with AI family member who malfunctions and needs to be repaired. That's kind of the setup of it. And Colin Farrell runs an errand to try to fix his robot. And we find out a lot about a lot of different subjects, such as memory, cultural competency, and things like that. I just found the movie to not exactly be about the plot. It is definitely a poetic type of movie, and it doesn't reinvent the wheel. It explores a lot of subjects that a lot of different sci-fi has explored before. For me, the way it approached it, both from a visual and thematic standpoint, I don't want to really spoil it. Visually, the way it brings you into the story, the opening credits are some of my favorite opening credits I've seen in a movie.
Credits are great. That dance sequence in the beginning, it tricks you because it's so kinetic. If you're expecting the plot or character development to come and salvage the movie, I don't think they do, to be salvaged by something else, this maybe poetic message. I just found it sleep-inducing, and I really, really wanted to like this movie. And I like Colin Farrell a lot. I thought his mustache and sunglasses, I think the costuming and the lighting is great in this movie. I really wanted to like this movie, and I was just falling asleep.
It does kind of lull you the way it set up the first act, and I don't mean this even in a bad way, kind of sleep-inducing, and then it really does open up in the end really effectively, and if you're able to stick with it. I think the child actress, Malaya Emma McKay, I believe, or Mika. She was great. I really love Jodie Turner-Smith and Colin Farrell. They do kind of have thoughtful, pensive type of dialogue that can drive people nuts. I am fascinated by memory. I'm fascinated by its connection to technology and people as we move forward, and definitely fascinates me and borderline kind of scares me. So this movie to kind of take such a comfortable approach for me was like a really pleasant experience. I believe the only movie on my list I didn't see in theaters from my top five.
So I'm gonna make my number five Turning Red, sort of a new Pixar movie. It felt very redundant to me, I would say. Certainly like appreciate the message of the movie. Envelope pushing, I think, in a way. The Pixar formula of main character turns into an animal of some kind or other sort of creature. We've seen that like so many times now that I felt like I kind of knew everything this movie was going to go. It just has, like, I guess, a spunky little twist on what it's really about.
Whatever Turning Red is kind of trying to do outside of the messaging part, which I agree with you is good. Everything Everywhere All at Once has just a better Chinese immigrant mother-daughter relationship type story. I tend to agree with everything you said for Turning Red. I also found the characters very annoying, and I found the anime just kind of bland and boring. Like, it was
trying I kind of did too.
It's trying to be this cool anime, but it didn't add up to me. And so, yeah, it's an honorable fifth position.
I went into this one with a little bit of raised expectations from kind of that initial buzz it had, and it was fine. It was like the first half was really exhausting to keep up with. Maybe I'm just too old for these movies, but it was like really hyper.
Admittedly, like, the three of us, not exactly the target audience
right. for this one. Yeah. I'm like, this.
So my number five has the number six in it. It's Compartment Number Six. It's a Russian movie. Obviously, a very popular country to make movies of now. It's a Finnish-Russian co-production, which is interesting because Finland is one of the neighbors of Russia, which is a bit nervous these days.
Yeah.
I noticed in looking back at the movies I've liked from the beginnings of the year, that often, I think this just makes sense intuitively, often a number of foreign language movies will sneak their way in because the foreign language movies will have actually come out maybe 2 years before in their native country and then have slowly, you know, taken a year or two going through film festivals to have arrived in, you know, like a US, English, whatever distribution release. So they'll pop out just kind of randomly in the beginning of the year. See like Baccarat, you know, in past years, Chinese movies set in Wuhan. But Compartment Number Six, sort of like a Linklater romance, a Finnish student and this like lower class minor are stuck in a long distance train car together as it goes to a small town in the Arctic Circle. They first kind of hate each other and can't stand each other. And I wouldn't necessarily say they fall in love, but they form a slowly hesitant respect and connection over the course of the train ride. A slow movie. It takes its time. It really puts you into a sense of place. It didn't always work for me, but it worked for me enough. And it also reminded me very, very strongly in my 20s, when I was living in China, I had a lot of kind of very memorable long train rides that never really took you exactly where you thought they were going to take you in terms of the experience, not the location. And you were introduced to different people. And that's what this movie does very well. Apparently, the young male actor who plays the minor is kind of like the it actor out of Russia. I don't know what that means for the future of his career. My number five is Compartment Number Six. You can find it on French Netflix, at least.
Russian Netflix.
I think it had an English release date in like March. But yeah, obviously a little bit under the radar.
So my number is The Batman, directed by Matt Reeves.
We will be talking about that in a little bit.
Blocked by John. John, is your number four The Batman?
My number four is Ambulance. Anybody see Ambulance?
Oh.
Crucify me if you will, but I really love Michael Bay as a director. I think, yeah, besides the Transformers movies, I really enjoy most of his other efforts. Like, I love The Rock. I love Armageddon. Those two movies are just endlessly, endlessly watchable, in my opinion. I really like when he steps outside of, you know, sort of what you normally expect from him, like we did with like Pain and Gain, which is like 10 years old now, which is insane. And this feels like really somewhere closer to that, where I just found it to be a really like passable, whatever it is, 2 hours.
Did you see Six Underground, the movie I think he made with Ryan Reynolds like 2 years
ago? No, that's I think the only one of his I haven't seen. Netflix gave him $18 kajillion, yeah. Do whatever you want. Yeah, I didn't see that one.
What was sort of celebrated with Six Underground is like the first 10 minutes is just this out of control, like Michael Bay is throwing every explosion and car chase at you in the first 10 minutes. Yeah, that was kind of my expectation of Ambulance.
I really like Jake Gyllenhaal, and he is very at his like unhinged in this movie, and I appreciate that. Definitely plenty to be entertained by, whether or not it's good. Yeah, I grew up playing Grand Theft Auto, and this is Grand Theft Auto Police on 4 stars all the way when you steal the ambulance. Not 5 stars. But 4 stars. It's very
maybe that's why it resonated with me so much too. Yeah.
I think it's resonating with a lot of people from our generation because of that. It is a PlayStation 2 game, kind of came to life. Very overdramatic, like it has like the thematic point how we treat war veterans at the beginning that only Michael Bay could handle in The Rock such a way. If you're signing up for a Michael Bay movie and you're like breaking it down from a certain angle, you kind of missed the point. I think it's a great Michael Bay movie. Not my favorite movie of the year, but I would rewatch that. Before even some of the movies on my list that I'll talk about.
Despite some of the kind of like big titles that have had people celebrating like, oh, wow, 2022 is already such a great year for movies.
Mm-hmm.
I actually am not so impressed so far. And again, I look back at the last few years, there were movies like Shiva Baby or Baccarat or my favorite movie of 2 years ago that I'm now forgetting what it's called. The sort of the lady with the horrible movie producer. And
I don't remember.
Must have been a good one.
Yeah. I'm just so bad with nouns, particularly.
Where's Av? No, you would know.
Yeah, Av would remember.
Postscript, the movie, of course, is The Assistant from 2019.
Those kind of movies came out in the beginning of the year, and it's reasonable that, you know, things can be sneaking into our top fives, our top threes, and not necessarily be like, oh, wow.
It's not like I didn't love that movie. I just thought it was good. It was fine.
I don't share the feelings you do on 2022 movies. Definitely my top two are two of my favorite of this century since 2000. Wow. So, yeah.
Dang.
And I have no problem really saying that.
My number four is Kimmy.
So I totally forgot about Kimmy.
If you forgot about it, then it should not be on your top five. So if not,
it's definitely in my top five.
Adjusting things on the fly, and you're.
I'm adjusting things on the fly. I'm sorry.
Okay, but I can't
kick out Turning Red. Even I already talked about it. I have to kick out my number three. I'm sorry, Jackass Forever.
Okay, great. Okay, so I will hold off on Kimmy because that's
going to be we have to talk about Kimmy later.
That leaves us with our top threes. Aaron, you want to lead us off?
My number three is. I talked about Memory early on, Gaspar Noé's Vortex. I just saw this last week. And when I mention movies I'm not going to rewatch, this is on the top of the list.
I can't imagine.
It's a brutal, brutal examination of dementia in a couple. Gaspar Noé wrote this while he was going sober and after he had a pretty major health scare. It's not like his other movies, definitely not a very provocative movie, very, very personal. You wouldn't know it was directed by him if you didn't. So if you don't like his other work, I wouldn't say that it should drive you away from this. I have a lot of experience with the disease of Alzheimer's and dementia overall, and it does get to me, especially when it's done in a respectful, kind of realistic manner, which this movie at times feels like you're in a documentary. There's some split screen cinematography that's just done in such a way that it really completely brings you in and tears you apart. Tried very, very hard, and maybe harder than any other movie. Definitely sadder. It's a hard watch. I'm not sure if I'll ever watch it again. I think it's a tremendous, not a really brutal process of dying with dementia.
The father keeps things at much more of a remove, I suppose.
This does not give you any space or breathing room the entire time. You are right on top of these characters. This is one of the all-time best dementia centric focused films that I've seen.
It's not like a movie to put on at work while you're sort of, you know, doing your back taxes or something.
Yeah, not at all. But this is a subject brought into a lot of movies and handled really poorly. When this movie is done from a really real place, even if it didn't work for me, I was going to respect it. And it did work for me on top of it.
Gaspar Noé famously directed Climax, which Will, one of our original founders of the podcast, his favorite movie when it came out in 2019 or so.
He hates Climax because people like Will love it.
He
just can't stand that Climax received such positive acclaim. He's one of those guys.
Not for me.
He would love the response. He's like, that's the point. You're supposed to hate it.
Av Sinensky and Sam Chester are Gaspar Noé's biggest fans. Who knew?
It's music to his ears that you guys hate that movie. That is like exact. That makes him so much. There's a great article where he talks about how hard it was for him to deal with the positive critical reception to his movie.
I have a foreign language as my number three. How about you, John? Are you going to three for three?
English language, and it's actually already come up on the podcast already. It's The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent.
Oh, I'm going to have to block you. That's my coming up for me as well. Not in my number three.
Though. Okay.
People keeping track at home, because we aren't, we have a few movies coming up that we've all mentioned and hopefully we'll discuss soon. My number three, I know at least one of you guys have seen it. It is Triple R, RRR.
Yep. Now,
it's this epic action film whose name is literally just the last initial of the director and the two stars. So that's why it's called RRR, bizarre, but it kind of gives you a sense of what you're getting into. When I say epic action film, forget about the word film. Forget about the word action. This is an epic in every sense of the word. It is so over the top. It's a movie is set in colonial India, and it's about these two real life Indian kind of revolutionaries in the kind of years before they were fully anti the British. So it's about their friendship, and it's really a bromance movie. Not only is it foreign language, but I watched it in the wrong language. And that is I didn't even know this. I know very little about India. India's biggest movie making industry is actually in the Telugu language. I tend to think of India as speaking Hindi, but actually Telugu is one of the biggest languages there. The movie industry in Telugu makes bigger movies than the Hindi Bollywood industry. I saw it dubbed in Hindi. So I saw it dubbed into another Indian language, not even the original Indian language it's actually in. Certainly most of the script went over my head because I don't speak Hindi or Telugu. I don't know how the watching experience was for you, Aaron, if you caught it maybe with some English subtitles or whatnot.
Yeah.
But suffice to say is you do not need to understand what they're saying to appreciate just this incredible action epic scenes. And I think Aaron knows what I'm talking about when he hears the stop in my voice. Absolutely incredible, some of the scene. And basically the bridge scene, Aaron, is what I'm talking
yes,
about.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's just absolutely incredible. It's just so over the top.
I was missing the subtitles half the time. I got where we're going here. So you didn't miss much with the loss in translation, Sammy. It's truly epic.
The bridge scene, and then basically my favorite scene is the bromance montage after the bridge scene, where yes. they're like running against trains and just doing ridiculous bromance. I mean, John, to put you into the context, it's these true, incredibly like manly men, like masculine India superheroes. It's very much like a Marvel movie. I mean, they're like superheroes and like they wrestle tigers. And then after the incredible bridge scene is how they meet. And then from there, there's just like a 10-minute montage in this it's like a long movie. The movie might be, it's like 2.5 hours at least. Good 20-minute montage of just showing the two of them like bonding by doing like very masculine things together, like running or carrying stuff or holding hands a lot. And in any Western interpretation, you'd say there's a very, I would think, heavy erotic, you know, subtlety to their relationship. But the movie seems to completely just ignore that. And just they're both presented as heterosexual type characters. Both of their love interests completely irrelevant. There's no real female characters in the movie from what I could tell. And so it's basically these just two Indian superhero men doing incredibly ridiculous things while loving each other. So I loved it. I had so much fun. RRR. I would urge everyone to see it. I mean, Aaron, is there any reason you would tell people to skip this?
I would highly recommend it. Shout out to East Street Cinema. So I got to see it with like two other people. So I had a private screening of RRR on one afternoon in the middle of the day.
It's the biggest moneymaker in Indian history. I mean, it's a...
I know. It's amazing. I really had a good time with this.
That brings us to your number two, right, Aaron?
Yep. And both of these movies, I definitely would say, are two of my favorites since 2000. My number one is one of my favorite movies I've seen ever, honestly. The Northman is my number two. Robert Eggers' film, Viking epic. The story that Hamlet is actually based on. So the critique of everybody saying this is just Hamlet with Vikings is completely backwards. I just think Robert Eggers is off to a legendary start as a director. His first three movies, I've loved them all. The Witch, The Lighthouse, and now The Northman. A completely kinetic and visceral experience. It's well acted throughout, an incredible score. They don't make epics like this anymore. The last time Robert Eggers is going to get $90 million, so I just basked in the glory of it and just enjoyed it because now it's getting released on demand after a short, unsuccessful theatrical run. Marvel movies are coming out or something, I don't know. But, you know, that's fine. I don't want to be that guy.
I don't know if either of you guys would know this. John, I know, is a bit more maybe Viking Danish heritage in his blood than at least myself. Oh. I don't want to speak for you, Aaron.
But yeah, I'd say more than me. I'm definitely not Viking.
I've watched bits and pieces of both the original Vikings HBO TV show and the new one, Vikings Valhalla. I watched the kind of History Channel version of the Vikings called The Last Kingdom. I watched Beowulf, the 2007 movie. Funny calling it animated, but I watched it when it came out, and I rewatched it actually this weekend. I watched this Japanese anime, and this is a proper anime, called Vinland Saga. Of course, I've seen Hamlet. I've seen the movies of Hamlet. I've read Hamlet. All of those Viking-related productions, and Hamlet is about a Danish prince, so I get that we don't think of it as a Viking tale, but I'm going to call it a Viking tale. Obviously not Viking as much as the Northman. My point to you, Aaron, is that, or I guess my point to John really here, all of those works are about a son having to revenge his father's death. Vinland Saga, it is entirely about a son from Iceland having to, very similar to Norsemen in terms of like the basic plot. I get that in Viking mythology, revenge plays a very large role. So I guess that's sort of, maybe that's just the explanation. I don't know, John, like why is it that every single sort of cinematic Viking story is ultimately a son revenging his father?
I don't know. I mean, maybe it's going to take Robert Eggers sort of opening the door to the whole Viking cinematic universe.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, credit to Thor in the MCU. I wouldn't consider a Viking figure, really. He's not really endlessly avenging Odin. He kind of, his daddy.
Well, he gets there, though.
MCU characters all have parent issues, but it's not really like revenging your dad who was killed. Like in these Viking stories I just pointed out, the dad was like hacked to death. And then, you know, like the revenge is much more visceral. John, did you see Northman?
There's almost like a 0% chance I'm going to see it because I found The Lighthouse, which was Robert Eggers' last movie, to be one of the like most unpleasant theatrical experiences of my life. And just don't really feel like going there with him again.
This is definitely his most easily approachable of his three movies.
Well, that ironically, like, I love The Witch, so I don't really know, like,
I think you would like this. Is much less Bergman, The Lighthouse, much more Game of Thrones, if Game of Thrones ended right.
I'll have to try it.
I liked Lighthouse more than Northman, and I didn't particularly like Lighthouse. My issue with Northman is that he's making like the anti-Hamlet. When you think of Hamlet, main characters constantly having these intellectual, should I kill my uncle, should I not kill my uncle, you know, centuries long debate of like, is my mother complicit with my father's death, or is she on my side? Shakespeare wrote this script, which is full of subtlety and which is full of doubt, and you just don't puzzle over things together with the characters. This is the anti-Hamlet.
Brutality.
Everything is straightforward. Yes, there's messaging about, you know, there's no real good guys in this. One brutal person versus another brutal person versus another brutal person. I mean, there's very little subtlety. The Green Knight, although I didn't like it maybe even as much as The Northman, it was a movie that had more challenging themes and subtlety, and the visuals were just much more inventive and the story was more inventive. Two of them sort of, to my mind, were contrasting a lot. In The Northman, it was just at some point, I get it, okay? You're just showing like big men hitting each other a lot with swords and rock. I don't need to see that 2 hours.
I appreciate the brutal approach here. And I came for the production and, you know, I did stay for some of the themes, but definitely it was the production, the performances that kept me engaged in this one. You kind of get where they're going right away. I think that's the idea. But yeah, fair enough.
I don't think the message at the end, the wife and the unborn kids are all going to be safe. In the Dark Ages, I don't think a woman with two infant twins without any husband to protect her had the highest chances of living more than a day.
I don't think it was a happy ending there at all. I didn't take that read as a happy ending. Just winning for the moment in his mind and not having this.
You can't take logic through this movie. I just thought it was like so many like dumb plot points, which again, you can't stretch. When they capture him, which I'm not sure how they capture him, he just gives up. I didn't really follow that. They tie him up and then they don't guard him whatsoever. They're like, here's your sword, I'm just gonna leave it by your feet, and we're all not important. If you want to defend it, you're welcome to. But what I will say about this, and John, this is the reason to watch the movie, if nothing else, this movie has by far the best final fight in a lava field. It's Star Wars how Star Wars should have been.
And there's a certain way it opens. It's a pet peeve of mine when movies open this way. I'll just say the opening shot works for me. And Bjork and Willem Dafoe are so great in their scene.
All the actors.
Nicole Kidman's great in this also. I'm a big Nicole Kidman fan, but I think she's really great in her role in this.
To me, it's a soft recommend.
If you're counting at home, there's two movies that I recommended my co-host here, Skip. So that's where I'm going here. I'm going to make number two, Kimmy, which was the movie that I loved so much I forgot about. Kind of snuck up on me because I was watching it, and for the first half hour to 45 minutes, I was not sure I was on its wavelength. Soderbergh's had these, probably like now 4, 5, or 6 movies since he like unretired. They really fall into two camps of, I absolutely love it, I'm flipping out right now, or I really am not digging this right now. And I was very worried that Kimmy was going down that latter road, but something about it just kind of took me over. I don't remember all the details of what I loved about it, but I'll say this, the sort of villain of the movie, not particularly present, but I found him so utterly detestable that dying for this movie to give a perp walk so I could feel satisfied at the end of it. And it's on TV for about 3 seconds, but I saw it and it happened and I was delighted. I loved that it was like a COVID movie without being a COVID movie. And it doesn't address COVID like at all, except for the fact that they go out in public and wear masks. And I just found that to be refreshing after a year of hyper low budget movies wanting to comment on what COVID is like. And this one kind of just moving on with life in a way that deeply, deeply emotionally satisfying.
Kimmy to me is like nice sucker, Ken. You know, it's fun. It's not.
Is it like a Black Mirror episode? What is the general premise of Kimmy?
She lives at home and she kind of goes over online content on like a Facebook.
Kimmy is Siri.
But she basically is supposed to listen to audio and then like flag stuff that's inappropriate or whatever it is. And she stumbles across something that suggests that violent crime took place. And then she tries to bring it to the attention of her, you know, corporate superiors. A lot of drama results to like leave her house for the first time, as John referred to.
She's like agoraphobic.
And okay.
That's COVID related or not is unclear. Yeah.
The whole Hitchcockian Rear Window, because like since she never leaves her house, she's always looking at people out of her windows and kind of imagining their lives. And then I thought for the first two thirds were really fun how the movie set up. And then on the one hand, I like short movies, so I appreciate the movie being short. On the other hand, like the entire way it wraps up is just so fast. Like
it did happen very fast.
The entire ending is just like, okay, bam, 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 bam. He's setting this really interesting, well-acted story up, and then it's gone. Online content moderation is this vast underbelly of the web. Facebook, I think, says it devotes 5% of its budget removing inappropriate content. And Elon Musk has said he wants to bring that back to Twitter now. Free speech for all and let everyone be as toxic as they want. The industry that Soderbergh has chosen to sort of poke at, how do you moderate content on social media, is really a fascinating topic, which I think we'll see in movies more in the future. It's a movie I'd really recommend. It was in my top five.
There you go.
My number two, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. I'm not like a massive Nicolas Cage fan. Generally see all of his good movies. And again, as John said, sure, his classic 90 movies are some of my favorite movies of all time. What I'll say here, I've heard other people say, so it's like not really so original, like, is that he has such a great chemistry with Pedro Pascal. Yeah. Nick Cage stops making crappy movies to go on vacation in Spain to meet a super fan. And then a lot of crap occurs. That's the best way to describe it. Nick Cage obviously played the meme version of Nick Cage. I've seen interviews where he goes, yeah, I had to like play someone named after me, playing the pop culture version of me, but not the actual me. So there's, you know, obviously meta elements there. There's a lot of kind of unnecessary parts of this movie. The whole CIA thing I thought was supposed to be there as like a red herring, but it ends up just kind of being like a no herring. Like it just doesn't go anywhere and the actors don't go anywhere. This movie made me laugh. It even made me cry. I definitely enjoyed myself. And it actually motivated me to go see Paddington 2, which I wouldn't have thought. So it was a lot of fun. And this was a movie that could have been crap. John, you've probably seen more of his movies than me. There's a lot of references I'm sure went over my head.
I mean, I went to see this with my wife and my in-laws. I was kind of surprised that they wanted to see it. It was my mother-in-law's birthday and she wanted to go to the movies and this is what she chose. I was like, oh, okay. So I was like, oh, is this going to be too meta? And it really wasn't. Yeah, I picked up on more references than maybe they did, but my wife, I don't think, could name, you know, too many Nicolas Cage movies, and she still really found it fun. And it really is what you said, it because he and Pedro Pascal have such great chemistry. I really love Pedro Pascal. He first came to my attention in Game of Thrones.
I think he's the breakout star of Game of Thrones. Person who appears in Game of Thrones that people have never heard of before, who's the most like, oh, wow.
He's got to be up there at the very least. It's a movie that probably got bogged down for some people because it has this unwieldy title. But when I mentioned it to people, I went to see that movie and they're like, oh, okay, I don't know what that means. I'm like, oh, is that Nick Cage movie? They're like, oh, yeah, like that looks fun. I'm like, yeah, well, it is fun.
Like early 2000s kind of comedic, having a fun time with itself action movie. Most of what it does, you expect. A lot of the jokes in it have been so overplayed. You know, the joke about the guys are at the wall and they can't get over it. And then like,
I mean, that was really funny, but I agree. Yeah, like,
I think that joke like, has even been done in Nick Cage movies, which maybe
it probably has. Most of the rest of it is, I felt like the comedy and the action were pretty separate, but that is like an actual like comedic action scene, which I appreciated because I don't think you get as many of those nowadays as you used to.
I know what John's number one is at this point, just by dint of the block that he's
sure. Here.
And I'm pretty sure I know what Aaron's is as well. And I think Aaron and I are basically in alignment. So Aaron, let me introduce your number one by saying The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent was one of my favorite multiverse movies this year with an ungodly title.
Yes.
I think this Nicolas Cage movie is really a multiverse movie because it's really Nicolas Cage working with all the Nicolas Cages of the past. And he literally has to go through these alternative pasts where he's Nicolas Cage in The Rock and Nicolas Cage in Sleepless in Seattle and et cetera. And like all those various Nicolas Cages like weave their way into the movie. Literally in certain cases, he pretends they're talking over his shoulder. You know, people are making a whole buzz these days in movie media about how, oh wow, there's like two big multiverse movies right now. There's Doctor Strange one, and there's the one that Aaron's going to talk about in a moment. But actually, I think there's three. or maybe more correctly, if we ignore the MCU, there's really two. Nick Cage in a multiverse movie, not to be missed. But what is the other big multiverse movie with an ungodly title, Aaron?
It was my number one immediately after I got out of the movie. It's going to be my number one by the end of the year. It's one of my favorite movies in that I've seen in a long time, honestly. A couple people got to see it before me, and they told me, this is going to be your favorite movie. You're going to love it. And I'm like, okay, I'm going into this movie with impossible expectations. It somehow beat it. Everything Everywhere All at Once. I finally figured out how to say it after talking about it for months now. It does so much, and yet all of it works together to make somehow a cohesive multiverse like none we've ever seen before. Beats out Doctor Strange, sorry. I did see Doctor Strange, it was fine. This was more than fine. And, you know, the rock scene's been talked about so much, but that scene, one of the most emotional scenes I've seen in a movie. When I talk about a movie taking shots, I don't think a movie takes more shots than this in a literal and figurative sense. And it's so different, yet it has so much heart, so much passion. Everybody shows up like nothing I've ever seen before. It made me cry several times for sure in many different ways. It would just shift from comedy to drama to action. It had everything everywhere all at once.
Everything All at Once and the Nick Cage movie, besides both being multiverse movies with long titles, both of them are also obsessed with calling out references. Movies with animal characters, Paddington 2 in the Nick Cage movie and Ratatouille. Mm-hmm. And Everything All at Once. My summary of Everything All Everywhere All at Once, so people know what we're talking about. Chinese immigrant family pays a visit to the IRS.
Essentially, that's what happens.
My take on it, and then my question. My number one as well so far of the year. It's an absolute marvelous mess of a movie that required and motivates you to rewatch it multiple times. So John, you may be one behind us, but I still have another few watches to go. It's my favorite movie of the century that started in 2022 and will end in, I guess, 2022. My favorite movies of last year, the top three or four, I'd like more than this. I'm so impressed at how much of the messiness it weaves together, like the smallest things, the googly eyes that her husband is leaving everywhere become so incredibly central to the plot. Everything in this movie, John, is like important, and they managed to put all this like massive multi-universe mess all together. And yet, I saw this movie this morning and I don't remember what really happens in the first 90 minutes. Somehow I think there's like an hour of movie too much. I think everything is used. I feel like the first hour and a half, did it need to be an almost 3 hour long movie? Here's my criticisms. Make of them what you will. Number one was what I already told you. I can't remember the first 90 minutes and I finished watching that movie 7 hours ago. Number two, the humor is pretty much all based on non sequitur. 99% of the jokes are the fact that they're hopping back and forth between multiverses. So characters are just confused as we are, indecipherable the actions are. And at a certain point, I was just like, okay, it is funny, but like you've made that thing go 50 times.
I think there's a little more to it than that. Great pop cultural references throughout as well. And physical humor, it's more than that. But I mean, you definitely, how crazy is this? I don't know what's going on. You can't really avoid that.
This movie is very front and forward. These are just regular people in their regular lives. And the fact that this like crazy sci-fi multiverse matrixy, it makes sense. I guess Neo accepts the Matrix very quickly because he's like a nerd who lives in that world. The Laundro lady that Michelle Yao is playing, like she has no reasons to want to embrace that there's no Matrix-like.
I appreciate that they don't really go into how the multiverse works and just show you how it works and don't go into exploring the inner mechanics. It didn't need to. It did not feel like 2.5 hours. And maybe that's part of why maybe I didn't remember the first 90 minutes either. It was so much movie, yet I didn't leave the movie feeling overindulged.
I think the movie ends really strongly. I think the last hour is really good. And I think the last hour weaves everything from the earlier. Everything is just woven back in a really powerful way. My last thing I'll throw at you, this movie has so much chaos going on. It has so much color. It has so much noise. It has so much costume. It has so much kung fu. I think they could have got rid of some of the kung fu. There's so much cooking going on. It's using all of that to communicate very timeless values about family and about appreciating the everyday and all those kinds of messages. Do we really need all that?
Blah.
On the screen to communicate these timeless values that be more powerful when they're not crazy mishmash going on all around them. So that's the thing that makes me not completely convinced by this movie.
I think that's fair. I think this approach really worked, and I'd be interested to see the Daniels next. I wouldn't be surprised if they go a more minimalist direction for their next movie to show they can do
that. This is so maximalist.
Absolutely.
I guess the last thing, bothered me. Even saying this makes me cringe. I had to close my eyes when it was happening on screen. The whole paper cuts.
That was brutal. I couldn't
follow why this guy, so John, at some point this guy's giving himself paper cuts to accomplish something. One of the heroes.
Really, it'd be tough for me to watch.
Yeah.
Between,
and he's repeatedly doing it. And like, I just couldn't watch. Close my eyes. And I was like, look, the movie's so long. If I close my eyes for 2 minutes, like, it'll be fine. I know you said, Aaron, that the movie doesn't really ask you to explain the logic so much. I had no idea any of the mechanics of this multiverse world. The men who are jumping on dildos.
The absurdity of life. When I got confused on a part, I was just like, isn't life absurd? It might be a little simplistic way of viewing it. And maybe on rewatches, I'll have a little more of a develop. But at the parts where it got so confusing, yet it still played a purpose in the role, I was just like, that's how kind of the absurdity of life plays. Okay,
so all of that went over my head. Like the mechanics of the multiverse thing was weird and it was funny often, but like I was like, I have no idea what's going on. I'm definitely gonna have to rewatch it.
Maybe it's something we'll talk about in a future episode once I get a chance to see it.
Maybe we're not so different. Who are you under there?
Tell me what you liked and why.
I'm vengeance. I loved the Batman. I had done a big Batman rewatch around the holidays. I never saw Tim Burton movies. I loved them both so much that I just went through and watched, including the dumb Joel Schumacher movies and into Christopher Nolan and a couple of the animated movies I'd never seen. So I was on a real Batman kick. I think I was starting to just kind of get psyched for this. I have such a hard time saying that it's like my favorite Batman movie because I really loved the Burton movies and The Dark Knight. I have such fond memories of seeing that at the time. But this one was definitely the one that it made me feel like unsettled. I felt like the production was just done in such a way. I was found myself like trying to keep up with terms of, oh shit, like it's really going there. It did not feel like a superhero movie in too many ways. It felt very grounded in a way that even like people said that about the Nolan movies, but I don't think that that's like super accurate. I thought the score was like so great in sort of setting the mood.
You know, Batman movies always have really great villains. I would say more so than most superhero movies.
Yeah.
When you think of it, you just watched all the Batman movies. You think of whether the cartoon or the non-cartoon, like the villains are what we remember as sort of then the contrast to whoever's playing Batman, I guess. It was just throwing villains at you left and right. I thought the main villain in this just didn't work very well. It's not fair to compare him to Jim Carrey. I think in general, the Riddler in Batman lore is just sort of like a weird version of the Joker.
Agreed. And it felt like this recalled Heath Ledger Joker so much, cult following that they were building. It was a version of that, but it was of the 2020s or, you know, whatever. Yeah. It was separate from the way that kind of takes place, I think, in 2008.
This Riddler was good, but not great. I actually liked the other two bad guys much more.
Penguin, well, Colin Farrell was hilarious. Yeah,
I thought the Penguin is the best part of this movie, and he's just such
he was
a
insane.
Yeah, and I think because he's being set up for like a TV show or maybe a sequel Batman movie, I don't know. He's my favorite part of the movie. I don't know Batman lore well enough. It took me until halfway through the movie to realize there were two different crime bosses. I thought they were the same guy. There's like Falcone and there's
Falcone and Maroney. Yeah.
Maroney. I had no idea what they were talking about. I thought it was just one crime boss. And I was like, wait, why is he against himself or something? crime boss, I thought, was also done very well. He was really, I guess, the bad guy for Catwoman and maybe less for Batman.
You know, they did Carmine Falcone in the Batman Begins, the first Nolan movie. Tom Wilkinson played him. It didn't feel like super menacing. Here you had Totoro, who was just, I thought, kind of inspired casting. And I just finished up watching Severance when I saw this movie. He plays the polar opposite of his character in this movie. So it was like really jarring, but it was great. Like a big sprawling kind of mess of a movie in some ways. Is it perfect? No. Will it hold up to like scrutiny under rewatch? Not necessarily, but I found so many fun details and the atmosphere of it all to be overwhelmingly satisfying.
Two issues I had with this is Batman is supposed to be the world's greatest detective, and the Riddler is supposed to be, I guess, the world's most nefarious riddle maker. Side of the Penguin, kind of having that ridiculous scene where he solves the riddle instantly and he makes fun of Batman for being an idiot and not being able to solve the riddles. Like, none of the riddles seemed particularly complicated, and they seemed to just be like Batman showed up, the answer was there immediately, and then, you know, it felt almost like a video game where it was just like you get there, you watch the cutscene, and you move on. Riddles just seem to be there to push the plot forward as opposed to being something with any challenge for the hero to really solve or challenge for the audience to solve. In certain cases, they were almost just told to us already. My second bit is like, what happened in the last 40 minutes of this movie?
Yeah.
I thought the movie was over once they got the Riddler. And then there was this whole weird scene where I had just no idea what was going on. The water, and they're getting wet.
They're leading through. He's a messiah. Something
is
like
the whole
that.
City dead now? Why is Batman electrocuting himself? Yeah. Two completely separate questions. Was it a problem that the riddles were too easily solved? And what was going on in the last 30 minutes?
I think they all, both of those questions kind of have the same answer, which is the Riddler wanted them to be solvable. Is this movie going to hold up to scrutiny? Because, you know, you look at The Dark Knight and that movie at the time when you're watching it, you're just sort of like so totally overwhelmed by what it's doing and how satisfying it is. But then you kind of think about the machinations of the plot and like it makes no sense.
Don't come at Dark Knight like that.
Dark Knight's gotten torn apart.
And I think this movie probably has a similar problem. I just haven't picked up on it yet. And I still like The Dark Knight, but the plot is too convoluted by half. Probably get at that this time where it's like he has to get best part of his plan to take place and then he'll escape and do the better part of the plan.
I mean, he's the world's greatest detective, so you don't want him to struggle too much, because then you're like, I thought this guy was the world's greatest detective. He should solve them easily. And the thing I more admired is how seamlessly like Batman is just kind of walking through the police department. And like, it does seem like the police like resent him. And I kind of could believe that and see that. It felt believable. It didn't feel grounded yet. It felt believable. So I kind of give the world building in this a lot of credit for that. The last 30 minutes kind of confused me too. But besides that, I really liked it. Loved the needle drop at the beginning. Got me right into the movie. Angsty Batman works for me.
This movie really works because there's no The Batman Begins. And because you are just getting thrown in and the whole movie is Batman Begins plus The Dark Knight in that sense of the full-throated plot movie and also the I'm trying to figure out what this character is about movie. You're just keeping up with it.
Did Pattinson, I think he was sort of robbed by the director because they didn't let him be Bruce Wayne at all, because it's hard to do too much when you're wearing a mask the whole time and you're just covered in leather and you're mainly just being asked to grunt and like punch. I wasn't overly impressed. You know, they always say like Bruce Wayne is really the role that Batman is acting. Like Batman is.
I think that gets a lot more focus on the sequels. Doesn't even know what being Bruce Wayne means at this point.
It just seems so obvious that the guy who played a vampire is now playing the Batman. You know, I know other people have said this, but it just seemed like such a one-to-one.
Yeah, he must be like a makeup artist like dream because he's got such a great face, but he is so off giving them the chance to just totally tear it down.
Yeah. Is he really the lead of this movie? Usually Batman movies, the villains are more the leads.
I think Gotham is the lead of this. And I think it's the love triangle between him and Catwoman and him and Gordon.
You guys maybe both saw this, but my favorite scene in the Batman may have been Batman goes Hannibal Lecter style to the jail to meet the Joker to try to figure out what make
Murray that was a good scene.
He likes little puzzles, doesn't he?
Why is he writing to me?
Maybe he's a fan of yours? Or maybe he's got a grudge against you, too. Maybe you're the main course.
Any theories?
This is very upsetting to you.
Let's get back to him.
Why? You're so much more fun.
I'm not here to talk about me.
What are you here to talk about?
I want to know how he thinks.
You know exactly how he thinks. You two have so much in common. Masked Avengers. So he's even more righteous. Oh, are you afraid he makes you look soft?
Wasting my time.
See more of that in the sequel.
The Batman is the only movie I saw in theaters this year, and I left the movie theater with my brother, and my wife was waiting outside, and that's when she told us she had just had a stillbirth. I can't really separate the movie fully in my head from that experience.
I can only imagine, I've had movie experiences, not quite like that. I don't want to make a comparison, but just where it takes place, like right around it. It's really impossible to separate those two things.
Yeah, no, I hear that.
Thank you guys for having me on.
Talk again soon.
Take care.
Life, free from destiny. Not only what we sow, not only what we show. This is a life.
Every possibility
from destiny.
I choose you and you.
me. Not only what we saw.